This is the Engine Room of Democracy, a podcast series that explores how the rules and values of constitutional democracy work every day in our government and in our lives. Here we will explore major questions facing America. How do we keep government institutions accountable to citizens? How do democracies control military force? What is lawful warfare? How do we enforce it? How do the courts enforce their judgments? How do we honor the right of privacy while our security forces use electronic tools to track down bad guys? I'm your host, John Hamry, here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Each week, I sit down with remarkable individuals who had senior government positions to discuss these questions. We explore together what it means to be a government of laws. Hello, everybody. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president at CSIS, and I'm delighted to have this session with you on the Engine Room of Democracy. I use that term because this is about how rule of law really works in American society. And the purpose of this is to help you understand how people that you pick to be senior leaders in our society conform with and live with rule of law. It's really a fundamental thing. We will be talking with senior government officials who have had very important positions in government and had to live with rule of law every day. And today, I'm so proud to be able to welcome Jamie Gorelick. Jamie served as general counsel at the Department of Defense. That's when I first met her. And she then went over to become the deputy attorney general. Now, I will tell you, I was intimidated by Jamie. I mean, I was the comptroller. She was the general counsel. And every meeting I had, she scared the hell out of me because she knew so much and I knew so little. And it was such a blessing to be able to have a chance to work with her. She's now a senior partner at the iconic law firm WilmerHale in Washington, and she's joining us today. The topic that we want to explore today is this question: what's the relationship of cops, prosecutors, and judges? How does this work, and how does it connect to rule of law? So, Jamie, if I may, the first question I want to ask is, what is the constitutional foundation for this? The Constitution has a lot of words about power of the presidency, about the power of the Congress, not so much about the judiciary. Tell me how you see this as a lawyer. What is the nature of the constitutional foundation for rule of law?
Well, I'd be happy to do that, John. Thank you for your kind introduction. This is the first I heard that you were afraid of me. You didn't act it. You had a very good poker face if there was any fear there. And it seems to me, since you controlled all the money, you had all the power. So let's just leave it right there. So now to your question. The framers of our Constitution constructed a very careful balance. And there are three articles that start off the Constitution. Article 1 is about Congress. And the concept there was that Congress is representative of the people. It was a little less representative at the outset than it is today. And even today, there are some issues. But it is the first branch of government mentioned in the Constitution. It makes the laws. So members of Congress vote on a law. It has to be signed by the president, although his veto, if you will, can be overridden. But basically, Congress makes the laws. The executive branch is the second branch. It executes the laws. And the construct there was that the executive branch would do what Congress said it should do, also sometimes honored in the breach. And when it is honored in the breach, the judiciary, the Article 3 branch of government, interprets the laws and administers justice and adjudicates disputes. So you happily have three, because if you only had two, you could have a standoff. So the third is the judiciary. And having said that, preserving and protecting the rule of law is the responsibility of all three branches of government, not just the judiciary. Everyone has the obligation to protect and defend the rule of law, and it is reflected in everyone's oath of office. Now, as I mentioned, the judiciary is the ultimate arbiter But the executive branch is responsible for executing the laws fully and faithfully, consistent with the rulings of the judiciary. And this is the structure of our federal government. It is also the structure of our 50 state governments, although there are slight differences among the states.
Jamie, can I ask you, this is so arcane and very sophisticated. I mean, most of us avoid it because we're afraid of getting caught in trouble, but we don't understand it. So what is the role and relationship of cops, prosecutors, and judges?
So the police are in that Article 2. They're in the executive branch, and their job is to execute the laws that are set out by the legislative branch. And in the case of most police, the legislative branch is in the states. So a crime is defined by the legislature. The executive branch enforces those laws. The police do not have the authority to impose a penalty for breaking a law themselves. You know, in other countries, that's not true. You can end up with a prosecutor and a judge being the same person. But we don't have that system. We have a separation. So the police, if there's a violation of the law, if you do something wrong, John, and I'm glad to know that you're afraid of messing with the police. We now have two of your fears out on the table today. Interesting. If the police believe that you've broken a law, they gather evidence and they present that evidence to a prosecutor. The prosecutor, also in the executive branch, also in that second branch of government, if the prosecutor agrees that there's a basis for a charge, she brings the charges herself in some instances, or for some very, very serious charges, a grand jury, which is a creature of the courts, has to vote on the charges. But let's put that aside, because for the most part, the executive branch, that second branch of government, is deciding whether to bring charges, and then the charges are adjudicated by the courts. Now, depending on the nature of the charge, the adjudication can be done by the judge himself or herself, or by a judge and a jury. But even where the decision is made by a jury, and, you know, you've seen this on television, the judge instructs the jury as to what the law is. The judge will say, if you find that the defendant, Mr. Hamry, did X and Y and Z, you may convict, but you have to find these elements. So what you see here is that all three branches of government participate in this process of law enforcement, and each has its own role. As I mentioned, that's different than it is in, for example, European systems in which the judge is also the prosecutor. But we've decided as a country, as a nation, to separate those functions. I personally think that separation of powers is a very important protection of our rights.
Jamie, there are some, quite specific provisions in the Constitution that affect me as a person in society. Things like the right to privacy, the right of habeas corpus. Tell me what that means in your world.
So after the Constitution was established, voted on, and our country was up and running, it occurred to people that there was no protection, really, very few anyway, protections of individuals against the state. And of course, that's what the revolution was fought over. I mean, the king made rules without any participation by citizens and had the right to enter your home, could script you into the army, call you off to jail. So we adopted, soon after the adoption of the Constitution, a Bill of Rights. And if you look at the first 10 of those, that's where you're going to find the kinds of protections that you're asking about. The protection of your right to privacy, the protection of the right to adopt and believe in any religion you want, and the right to be free of the state imposing a religion on you, the right not to have to testify against yourself, but because people were, hauled off and tortured and made to confess. And that was one of the things that we rebelled against. So the government can't throw you in jail without charges. It can't force you to incriminate yourself. Now, who enforces those rights? Well, everyone is obliged to respect them. So the entire executive branch, from the cop on the beat to the president of the United States, is sworn to protect those rights. But how is that enforced? It's enforced by our courts. who have fashioned various remedies for violation of our rights. You can sue if you feel that your rights have not been respected. Evidence that's taken in violation of your rights can't be used against you in many circumstances. Charges can be thrown out or dismissed if they're premised on violation of your rights. You probably have heard in connection with the Black Lives Matter movement and the various solutions that have been proposed in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd, that police have, quote unquote, qualified immunity, which has really made it very, very difficult for citizens to sue police when their rights have been violated in their view. That is a problem that is being addressed right now in our legislative branch and also in our judicial branch.
I hope that we find a better solution than we have today. Jamie, let me just ask, you know, cops can't lock up people without prosecutors and judges. Prosecutors depend on the facts that they get from cops. Judges are responsible for ensuring kind of an equitable and fair process. This is a very complex dynamic. How does it really work? It suggests that there's really a set of folkways that are much more important than we realize.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, we have the law and then we have lore. As I mentioned a minute ago, a police officer's conduct is constrained by the judgment of prosecutors and the rule of law is decided by courts. But as a practical matter, prosecutors are very dependent on the police to build their cases, and they don't have resources really to double check the facts presented. So while a lot of television justice is inaccurate, one of the things that is accurate is the prosecutor says to the cop on the case, if you want me to bring this case, you need to bring me evidence of X. You don't have enough evidence of Y. Or I don't really believe what you've got here. I want to meet the witness. And so there is this, as a practical matter, some tension between the prosecutor and the policeman, because the prosecutor is the one who's got to stand up in court and say, this is, Your Honor, the evidence that I have. This jury is the evidence that I have. Judges then have to review the charges and make sure they're consistent with the law. The judge's ability to make sure that the evidence is consistent with the law is really dependent on what's called the adversary system. So again, back to television justice, you see a prosecutor and defense counsel. If you didn't have defense counsel, you wouldn't have somebody who could say, well, actually, Your Honor, this fact that has been asserted isn't really true. Or this fact that has been asserted and proved doesn't meet the standard of the law. The problem is that as a practical matter, the ability to ensure that defendants actually have such counsel is constrained by lack of funding. Much more funding is given to prosecutors than to public defenders. And so the system is premised on checks and balances, but in practice, it's tilted toward the government.
Jamie, I'm going to depart from my questions here just to ask you. Okay, so at one point in time, we had to push something called the Miranda rights because we felt that cops weren't doing it right. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's right. So what we're talking about here is a case decided by the Supreme Court called Miranda. And it basically said that if a potential defendant was not warned by the police, or for that matter, a prosecutor, that statements that he or she made could be used against him or her, that evidence could be excluded. That was considered to be a very harsh result because you could be prevented from actually prosecuting somebody who had done what they were charged with doing. On the other hand, there didn't seem to be any way of making sure that the government was abiding by the rules. Now it is part of the fabric of policing. Everyone knows it. They know what they need to say to comply with Miranda by heart. They used to carry little cards and read the words, but now it's kind of ingrained. And the process is called Mirandizing. It's now a verb. So I think Miranda is good. I think the process that we have now is good. And I think most police, even ones who objected originally, feel the same way.
It's so interesting because it seems like one of those internal correction mechanisms, you know, to kind of bring balance into this dynamic. Jamie, let me ask you about how politics plays in the judicial system. You know, there's a lot of talk these days that the attorney general is being political, et cetera. There's a bit of cynicism in the country right now about this question of political pressure on the judicial system. What do you feel about this?
I feel it's bad. As a former senior Justice Department official, I mean, I did and my attorney general did everything we could to assure the public that the rule of law was being imposed without regard to politics, without regard to race or gender or where you came from, that it was being applied impartially. And that, of course, has been the ideal in our federal judicial system for a very long time. Right now, our federal judges are identified regularly by the president who appointed them. If you read an article about a judicial decision, you're very, very, very likely to have a next sentence after the decision is described in which the judge is identified by who appointed him or her. That's not helpful. And it's particularly not been helpful for the president to excoriate judges based upon who appointed them, even prompting the current Chief Justice, who is a Republican, to assert that there are no Republican judges or Democratic judges, just judges trying to do the right thing. But when you have in the Supreme Court 5-4 decisions that decide elections with 5 Republicans voting that George Bush should be the president and 4 Democrats voting that Al Gore should be the president, it's very, very difficult to convince people that the judges are not just voting based upon who appointed them. And that is corrosive to our system. It's not supposed to be the way it works.
Can I ask you, Jamie, I mean, you were Deputy Attorney General, a political appointee. We have a system where the senior law enforcement officers of the country are appointed by politicians. How does that work really in practice?
Well, the policies of a Justice Department are going to change with administrations, just as when we served at the Defense Department together, the Defense Department's policies might change. And you'll see, for example, that the enforcement of civil rights, of environmental protections, of antitrust enforcement, that they will be stronger in a Democratic administration than a Republican one. And we've seen that ebb and flow for a very long time. In addition to that, criminal justice priorities are going to change in different administrations. For example, how many resources does the Department of Justice put into gun crimes or drug crimes? That's going to change with different administrations. What should not change are the fundamental decisions about who is investigated and who should be charged. You should not have, and it has forever been the view of departments of justice, you should not have a politician calling for someone to be prosecuted. It's not right. And it's not what our Justice Department stands for. And I am very worried that the current Justice Department is being told what to do by the president. And I think that's why people are so upset by the decision, for example, to drop the charges in the Flynn case after Flynn admitted what he had done wrong and as he was just about to be sentenced. So, you know, we had one other president who directed his Department of Justice as to who to investigate and who not, and that was Richard Nixon, and he was impeached for it.
Yeah. Jamie, let me just ask, both the executive branch and the legislative branch are able to establish their legitimacy to the American public by standing for election. And there's a certain kind of validation of their stature because they stand for election. The judiciary, however, is constantly dealing with conflict, conflicting interests and objectives, and between private sector, public, et cetera. The core question I'm trying to ask you is, how does the judiciary establish its legitimacy? The Congress and the president stand for election. That gives them legitimacy. How does the judiciary establish legitimacy?
That's a really interesting and hard question. And the answer to that question has evolved over time because, of course, the judicial branch has no army. So when it decided, for example, that schools in our country had to be desegregated, there was an open question whether our federal government would actually send U.S. Marshals into schools to help desegregate them. And I don't know what would have happened had the federal government in the executive branch not supported what the judicial branch had decided. Similarly, when the Supreme Court decided that Richard Nixon needed to turn over the tapes during the Watergate investigation, what would have happened, since he controlled the executive branch, had he refused? He didn't. He turned over the tapes and they led to his impeachment. I think maybe if he hadn't turned over the tapes, he still would have been impeached, but we don't know. So this is a delicate balance. The judiciary has to establish its legitimacy by being and seeming to be above politics, which is why I answered your earlier question the way I did. If judges are perceived as simply voting proxies for their party, the American people are not going to accord the judiciary the respect that it needs, because that's all it has. That's all it has.
Maybe can I ask you, the world changes dramatically and sometimes quickly. You know, just see, let's just think back over the last 4 months about COVID and the murder of George Floyd. I mean, the world changes very quickly. Laws change slowly. And the question, and I hear this frequently expressed about the court, what should be the court's perspective? Should it reflect the way that the world is changing, or should it try to anchor to the past with fundamental principles? How do you view this? What should be the perspective of the judiciary dealing with a change in society?
You have probably heard about the view that Justice Scalia had of the Constitution, which is that you need to abide by the original text, which of course makes sense if you're talking about the principles embodied in the Constitution. But since so much of what is happening today could not have been imagined by the people who wrote those words, you can't, as a practical matter, bind yourself to the actual words and nothing else. I mean, if you did, we would still have no voting rights for women. We would still consider blacks to be 3/5 of a person. I mean, I can go through text after text and show why they would not make sense in the world that we live in today. The courts are bound by something called precedent, which is that if a case has been decided in a certain way, and another case comes up raising the same issue, you are bound to decide it the same way, which gives you a sense of continuity, and it ensures that there is not lawlessness. Now, every once in a while, the court, the Supreme Court and other courts will decide that the original case was wrongly decided. But if courts simply said willy-nilly every day, I don't like the way that decision was made 2 years ago, I'm going to ignore it because I'm now the judge that has this in front of me. That respect that you were asking about, that basis of legitimacy that you were asking about, would be undermined entirely. So the fact of the matter is, we are bound by precedent. We very rarely overrule precedent. So you see, for example, in the decision on the abortion case in Louisiana, you have Chief Justice Roberts joining for Democrats in striking down a law in Louisiana because it had 2 years ago struck down basically the same law in another state. Now, he said, look, I didn't agree with how that case was decided 2 years ago. I was in dissent, but it is our precedent and I'm going to uphold it. That is the kind of decision that allows our courts to be respected and balances this literalism on the one hand and the, if you will, realism on the other.
You're uniquely skilled to answer this. You know, normally most of our courts are open, the rules very objective, but we have something called the FISA court. It's a court that was set up 40 years ago, designed to deal with secrets. It raises questions. There's a lot of controversy recently about the FISA court. Most courts establish their legitimacy by publishing their rulings. Why did they rule the way they did? The FISA court doesn't do that. Can you tell us how you think about the FISA court? For our listeners, this is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, and it's a special court that allows the government to spy on people under specific rules, but it's controversial now. Tell us how you think about the FISA court.
Well, let me take the history back one step before there was a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was that presidents just asserted that they had the right to spy on spies. And that's the counterintelligence function. So I'm the president of the United States. So I'm charged with protecting the national security of the United States. And I say, you, John Hamry, are a spy and you're a threat to our national security. So I'm going to authorize a black bag job, is what they were called, to go into your house and take information that I think might be relevant to your being a spy. And I'm going to put a wiretap on your phone, listen to everything you say. That's what happened. That's what J. Edgar Hoover did with Martin Luther King. That's why J. Edgar Hoover had as much power as he did, because he used various means to learn about politicians and then make them aware of what he had. So you might not like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, but it's compared to what? So the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act applies to two kinds of evidence gathering. One, electronic surveillance, and two, physical intrusions by authorizing someone to go into John Hamry's house. The first was in place when I was Deputy Attorney General. The second, I advocated for coming under FISA because we had a spy case in which we authorized an intrusion into somebody's home because that was the only way to get the evidence. We did find evidence of his being a spy. He was convicted, but the Attorney General said, I don't want to make this decision on my own. This is a decision that needs to be overseen by a court. So in defense of the process that we have, it's better than the alternative. Okay, now let's look at what happens in the FISA court. Because it's dealing with national security, not just secrets, but secrets about spies or alleged spies, it does have to undertake its business in a secure facility that protects those secrets. There is a process. It depends very heavily on the honesty and care of our various spy agencies and the intelligence function of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the oversight within the Department of Justice of all of that. And the court is dependent on that honesty and care. And if the process isn't undertaken with honesty and care, it's really hard for a court to ferret that out. A FISA application might be 5-6 inches thick. And understanding what's in it and getting underneath that is really hard. Having said that, the FISA court, in my view, is tough. It asks tough questions. It sends applications back all the time so that when people say, well, it's a rubber stamp because only, you know, a very small percentage of FISA warrants are turned down by the court, that doesn't count all the times it said you need to withdraw it and come back to me when you've done your homework. Recently, the court has also been able to hire pro bono, but have advocates for a contrary position so that it will have, you remember I mentioned before how reliant courts are on the adversary system? Well, now it can have adversaries in front of it arguing two different positions, and that helps a lot.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. That's really an important thing. I remember my time in government, I signed an awful lot of petitions, you know, to the FISA court, and I was always frustrated.
After I reviewed them, though.
Never before you approved them.
Yes, so you weren't, you didn't have free-floating.
That's true. I mean, I followed your direction. I mean, believe me. But I noticed something. Every time we asked to do something we'd already done, they said yes. Anytime we asked to do something we'd never done, they'd said no.
Well, that's a slight exaggeration. If you had a FISA warrant on Mr. X, and you had proven to the court's satisfaction that that was predicated on facts that met the standard of FISA. But the warrant only lasted 6 months. The court would simply look to see what it is that you gained from the wiretap and why it was that you needed to continue rather than going through all the processes again. And therefore, the chances of getting a renewal were much higher. On the other hand, that process of getting that first one, as I mentioned earlier, could be tough.
It's tough. It was tough. It was high. And honestly, I think that was appropriate. Jamie, one last question before we wrap up, and that is the judiciary is an independent branch of government, obviously, but it is subject to some oversight by the Congress. Could you describe what that is and how you feel about it?
Well, I mean, congressional oversight is supposed to take place over the executive branch. The only real authority for Congress to oversee the judiciary is in the confirmation process and in the impeachment process. So that's designed to give judges leeway to make decisions and not have their decisions second-guessed by politicians. I mean, we have lifetime appointments on our Article III courts. And that, in my view, is as it should be. Now, what about when Congress is overseeing the executive branch? In my view, having served in three different executive agencies, you make better decisions, I think, when you know that somebody's going to ask you questions about it. You know, I always thought to myself, I'm going to make this decision. How do I justify it if I'm called to a congressional hearing or even just by an individual member of Congress? How do I justify that in public? That's another part of our checks and balances. But the executive branch has to be willing to honor the demand by Congress for information. And if it isn't, Congress doesn't have an army to go seize that information. And so that's not a great situation. So two things. One is the process that the subpoena that a committee of Congress might vote on is only enforceable through the judiciary, and that takes a long time, so long that it can frustrate legitimate congressional oversight interests. At the same time, we've also seen Congress use oversight as a tool to harass and to make political points, which are not what was intended when Congress's oversight responsibilities were laid out. So I would say this is a sorry state. You served in two of the three branches of government, never been a judge, but pretty good in the other two roles.
I couldn't pass the IQ test.
Oh, please. But I would dare say that when you were on the Hill, you did oversight appropriately and not as a tool to harass. And when you were in the executive branch, you thought a lot about what your oversight committees and others would be asking, and you respectfully went up when asked to go up and explain. We do not have either one of those right now.
It's sad because, you know, an independent judiciary is the crown jewel of democracy. And it's so impressive to talk with you, Jamie. Let me just summarize kind of the big themes that I've heard today. Rule of law is just, it's central to our Constitution. And it depends on institutions that we create to ensure that there's a framework. And it depends on procedures that as a society we honor and we consider to be foundational. But it also depends on a consensus that transcends politics, that there's a greater good in America to have an independent and objective judiciary. Any final comments, Jamie?
So that piece of the triangle that we have as our fundamental constitutional construct is out of whack. And we have a judiciary whose independence is questioned simply by the fact that people expect it to operate politically rather than as impartial arbiters. The checks on an executive branch that has tried to accrete too many powers to itself is primarily in, number one, the judicial branch, number two, our press, and number three, the cohort of career people who work in these agencies, which some call the deep state, and I call good citizens trying to help our country. You can see our Chief Justice, very, very worried about the role of the judiciary and how it is perceived. In the Supreme Court building, in the main conference rooms, not where the justices meet privately, but in the public rooms, there are the portraits of the Chief Justices. And the court in the term of the Chief Justice is known as the Burger Court, the Rehnquist Court. This is the Roberts Court. And if the Roberts Court becomes known as an institution that simply votes along party lines, the judiciary will not recover from that. It will not have the respect that we have traditionally accorded our courts. And so I think he is trying very hard, and you've seen it in a couple of instances, to find a narrow ground on which he or one other or two other Republicans can agree with Democrats. He has encouraged Democrats on the bench to join Republican majorities, but we're on very shaky ground right now because of the politicization of our courts, because we have political leaders who excoriate judges of the other party, because our press has now been covering our courts as if the judges were just extensions of the president who appointed them. So we will see. We will see. I, for the most part, have been very proud of our judges. I think they have tried very hard to abide by their oath and to make decisions based upon the merits. But the public perception is worrying, and sometimes for very good reason. So I hope that that wonderful set of checks and balances with the three branches of government holds, because it is the foundation of our society. Respect for the rule of law.
Jamie, I feel like I'm the bat boy invited to go to the All-Stars game. You've been fabulous to educate me today. Thank you. Thank you for taking this time. It's been inspirational and extremely informative. I'm very grateful.
Well, thank you for having me, John. Anytime you want to ask a question, I'm happy to answer it, if you know.
Okay. Thank you, Jamie. I really am very grateful. Thank you. We'll see you later.
See you later.
All righty. Bye-bye now.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts. From Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog